Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Rodance. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome. Thank you, Paul, for making me feel welcome, and Bill for asking me. And it's a nice group you got here. I've been here a few times. And to the brave people who would come up here and get chips, good for you. You know, to run the gauntlet of these guys. Why do we do that? Yeah, really. Now, why do we do that? Why do we do chips? It was explained to me, I didn't want to do chips. There's probably no way I would do this, but I mean, it was explained to me we do chips to show others that it works. You know, and I think that is important. We got to show people that this works, because as you may have noticed, there's a bit of an attrition around here. People tend to leave after a while. Is this loud enough? Can you hear me? Okay. A little louder. Can you raise this up without making a noise? All right. Thank you. That's better. So I'm an alcoholic. What do I mean when I say that? Well, all of you, most of you, know what I mean because you say it too. You know, I saw you raise your hands and I saw you get your chips. So I know that you think you're alcoholic. So on some level, you know what I'm talking about. But you know, one of the things we mean when we say I'm an alcoholic is we mean I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. I screw up. In fact, I can't make it through life on my own. That's really what alcoholism is about. This is a disturbing thing for my ego to think about. I can't make it through life on my own. That's what it means. What does it mean if we're trying to make it through life on our own? It means we're filled with pride. All right? And we're going to do it. And when I first came to AA, by God, all I wanted to do was learn how to not drink. That's really what I wanted to do, was learn, when do you teach me how to not drink? Where are the classes? You know, when do we talk about not drinking? Let's talk about not drinking. How do we do that? I didn't know how to not drink. And I couldn't do it on my own. I can't make it through life on my own. That was true then, and it's true now. I got to go to meetings. I have to immerse myself in with people like you. And I do because it works, because I feel better when I do that. When I'm left to myself trying to make it through life on my own, disaster. Disaster. I'm a blackout drinker. Okay, I'm half proud of that. All right, I'm a blackout drinker. There's different kinds of alcoholics discussed in the book, and one of the things you can say about blackout drinking, which of course is drinking and continuing to do stuff and not have any idea what it was the next day, and be often quite surprised when they tell you what you were doing. One of the things about that is that is one of the diagnoses, one of the pathognomonic, it's called, one of the ways by which you define the disease of alcoholism. Meaning, if you're a blackout drinker, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about alcoholism. Other people will also fit the bill of alcoholism, and we heard that. It's about if you're unable to control your drinking, you know, and I was unable to control my drinking, but I also blacked out. I figured out the other day when I started drinking. I've been sober since January 28th or so, 1988. And I started drinking when I was about 8 years old. And I figured this out the other day because, all right, no one in here will remember this, very few people. But there was a guy named Nixon and a guy named Kennedy, and they had debates on television in 1960. And all I really remember about that was my parents watched it in the other room, and I got stinking drunk. And I was born in 1952, so I was 8 years old. And the reason I figured that out the other day was I knew I got drunk during the Kennedy-Nixon debates, but I never thought about when they were. And I was reading a newspaper article from 1960. Oh, God. I was 8 years old. Well, I didn't just drink a little. I got stinking drunk that night. I mean, it really worked for me. I loved it. It was great. It was exciting and dizzy, and I don't know what I did that night. I woke up the next day, and I'd feed the bed and all that, and which is kind of, that was my pattern, by the way. I was a urinator. Some of you are vomiteers. I'm more of a urinator. I'd ruin the couch, you know, on numerous occasions. There's some amends I guess I haven't made, you know, but man, that's that's a tough amends, you know. Because first I have to find out if they, if I did it, because I don't really, you know, anyway, because I was a blackout drinker. So anyway, I loved alcohol. It works for me perfectly. It made me feel comfortable. You know, you hear a lot about not feeling good around here and the hole in your soul and all that. I didn't know that was true. All I knew was alcohol was great. And I just drank every occasion, all the time. My parents had alcohol in the house. They're not drunks, but they drank. They still drank. And there was always all kinds of alcohol around, and that's what I drank, all kinds of alcohol. And I mixed them all together all the time. And I would take a glass of wine, and I'd pour in an inch or two of vodka or whiskey or port or anything to make it stronger, and I'd slug that down, and then I'd go to school, or I'd go to the basketball game, or I'd go out, you know, and that made it okay. I could interact with my peers, because without that, I hated my peers. I hated high school. Hated those people. I can remember the last day of high school as I walked in, screw you, I'll never see you again. There was no reason for that, you know? I mean, they didn't really treat me badly or anything. I don't know why I hated them so. We're like that. We're like negative people. With alcohol, I liked them fine. I could go and function, you know, go to the dance and stuff. But without it, I just hated them. And didn't get along, and took it all personally. And I'm sure none of it was real, because we also have altered sense of perception of what other people are thinking, you know. So I went to college. I did every drug that came along, of course, and it intensified my alcohol experience. And I continued to pass out and black out, and then sometimes pass out. And I continued to pee wherever I laid. Let's see what happened. I was the guy who would I'd be up on the third floor of the sorority, banging on the door of the fire escape outside the sorority house. Manny and Karen come out at 3 a.m. I want to see Karen. I don't know Karen. I've never met Karen. She's a senior. I'm a freshman, you know. And I didn't know I did that. I got a foggy memory of it, sort of. And they told me the next day, you know, and the police and everything. And that's the kind of stuff I did all through college. I didn't get kicked out. But we were pretty liberal back then. I was in New York State. It was an 18-year-old drinking state. And we just drank. So I drank my way through college, graduated from college, and went to medical school. Medical school is a wonderful place to do drugs and drink. Because, for one thing, you all bring us drugs, you know. Thank you very much. You would bring in these little brown paper bags filled with all these little pill bottles in the emergency room, and I'd get to go through them. And I'd know what they were, you know. And I'd say, Tylenol and codeine. Well, no wonder you were nauseous, you know, and I'd put it in my pocket. Take that later. Oh, Percodan. I'll bet that doesn't work for you. I know it'll work for me, you know, and I put that in my pocket. So. And our parties were fabulous, you know. And I was kind of growing out of the urinary thing slowly, which is good. So I went to medical school, and I graduated and moved to Phoenix, Arizona, which is a bit of an overreaction from living in Buffalo, New York. And I moved to the other side in the middle of June. It was like 117 degrees. And went to internship and residency in Phoenix, and nothing really changed, you know. I mean, I'm a drunk. And we drank. And you could drink a lot in Phoenix when it was 117. I mean, there was no such thing as paying any attention to somebody drinking beer in the car. Always had beer in the car. Anyway, so I went through residency and nothing changed. Well, things started getting a little worse, you know. I mean, I started unraveling a little bit. The guy across the street from me was unraveling a lot more than I got a new car accident. Judge told him to go to AA. I went with him to AA. I had gone to an AA meeting or class, maybe we thought it was, back in high school. We had to drive all the way downtown, and there were very few people way up front, and we sat way in the back. We were a little class of senior high school kids, and I had no idea what was going on or why we were there, but at least I knew AA existed. I mean, I knew there was a secret society of drunks. So my friend got assigned to go, and I went with him. A bunch of older people sitting around. It was pretty miserable. It was pretty miserable, you know. And that's one of the things I can say about the new folks here that really impresses me when you're getting chips and stuff, is that for new people, I know that you're not happy. You're not happy to be here. I wasn't happy to be here. Who wants to go to AA, you know? This is not, like, the best place to... We don't... Even the coffee's bad, you know? We don't do a lot of good stuff here. on the surface. We don't have good pizza. Nobody wins any money except for the treasurer. And, you know, it's a miserable place to have to come on some level because it means my life is over, right? I mean, my life is over. So I'm watching this stuff, and it's just not turning me on. Anyway, he got sober maybe, and I didn't. And I moved to San Mateo, California. I went into private practice, and things continued to get worse. And I started kind of passing out in public, and I was always drunk driving home, and just worse and worse things. Finally, it just really came down to I should start going to some meetings. I have to learn how to not drink, you know. I got to learn how to not drink. So I started going to some meetings. I went to a perfectly miserable, in my recollection, getting sober meeting, which is about reading the little yellow book and talking about how to not drink. I mean, that's sort of what they were talking about. And every so often they would talk about God. There's one of the chapters towards the end, or maybe more than one, it's probably like most of them, talk about God as being the answer. And I just sat in the back with my arms crossed. They had pretty good cookies. But otherwise, my arms were crossed, and I was just unhappy, and I couldn't believe we're talking about God when we should be talking about how to not drink. You know, we have to get me sober. This is serious. Before we go into the meeting, people are laughing and stuff. It has nothing to do with my problem. I have to get sober. I have to learn how to not drink. When are we going to start getting me sober? And that was my attitude. I didn't talk to anybody. I wasn't happy to be there. I would put a dollar in the basket and hope everybody noticed. I would leave on time, you know. But on some level, I felt, okay, we're a little secret society of screw-ups, you know. It kind of felt a little good as we were all disseminating from that room into society, like, okay, we got away with it a little bit. We're all calling for meeting secretly. Break. We all, you know, go out through the community and see y'all tomorrow night. Don't get arrested, okay? I know I'm going to drink. I don't know what you're doing. You know, some of you claim to have years of sobriety, I'm sure. And then there was another meeting I went to, which was a professional meeting in downtown San Francisco, which means I had to drive about an hour to get to it. And it was for doctors and lawyers and stuff. And that was a pretty miserable meeting, too. And, again, I didn't join. I didn't appreciate being there. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't know why I went to that meeting, but I kept waiting for the answer. You know, when is the light going to come on? And you guys would talk about stupid stuff like God and spirituality and all this stuff. And when do we get to the point? You know, the point is, how do I not drink? So, what happened? So I went on a ski trip, and I fell, which is really a remarkable thing. I'm a good skier, and I fell. My bindings broke. Okay, and I didn't know that. Actually, my bindings broke, and I didn't know it. God broke my bindings, which is really pretty funny. I didn't know it for a year. I thought I fell. I thought I had done it, you know. And I fell, and I landed on my elbow, and I broke three ribs. And I had a cold, and which went into pneumonia. As it was going into pneumonia, I did all the drugs and all the alcohol that we had brought with us. I did all that because I couldn't ski anymore. So then I went into detox. I went home. My wife had cleaned me out. She had cleaned out. She found everything, really. And what she didn't find, I didn't know where I put it anyway. So, I couldn't find it. But she found everything that could be found, and she threw it all out. And so I went into detox with pneumonia with broken ribs. And that's like 102 fevers and coughing, which is killing me and all that. And what happened was my brother came over. After a couple of days, he came over, and this was the end of January, right, 1988. So I had this Happy New Year's hat that was silver. It said Happy New Year. And it had these silver balls on springs coming out of the top of it. I thought it was pretty sharp. It looked good, you know. And I looked pretty good when I had it on, I thought. So I was lying in bed, sitting up in bed with this hat on. This is like January 26th, you know. And my brother came in, and he looks at me, and he says, "Get up and get dressed." And I said, "Where are we going?" He says, "Shut up." And they took me to Stanford ER, and they kicked me out, and they drove away. And my wife and my brother said, "Get sober or get lost." And they drove away. And this was on a Friday night. And I went into Stanford ER with my hat on. And I went up to the gal at the window, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I have to get sober." And ka-ching, 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 you know. And she, that didn't faze her a bit. This happens every Friday night. You know, okay. And my plan was to stay a day or two, you know, because I don't have insurance. I mean, I'm never going to get sick. And so I never bought insurance. And so I'm going to stay a day or two. This is going to be incredibly expensive. I don't know how I'm going to do it for, blah, blah, blah. It's all going on in my head. I'll stay a day or two. This is a great opportunity for me to get a day or two in without alcohol, because I couldn't do it. Now, prior to that, going to meetings, I had been smart enough to get a big book. After all, you say go get a big book. Now, I was smart enough not to buy it at a meeting, because if I bought it at a meeting, you'd know I was a newcomer. And I couldn't admit that. Well, I can probably never raise my hand as a newcomer because it was too busy being folded in my chest. So I went to the central office in the town to buy the book. And they had hardcover books, and they were $4.25 back then. And they had softcover books. And I didn't know how much they cost, but I knew the softcover book would be cheaper, so I bought a softcover book. And the joke there is that they're the same price. Okay? So I bought a softcover book, and I went home, and I poured myself a drink, and I started to read it. Which is really a good definition of an alcoholic, isn't it? I mean, you know, when you think about it, I'm sitting there reading the big book with a drink, trying to learn how to not drink, which it doesn't teach you anyway, you know? But some stuff occurred to me while I was reading it, because I immediately went to how it works. Because, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I want to know, how does this work? Okay, I look at I'm not dumb, so I look at the table of contents, this introduction, there's like, you know, what, 17 pages of little tiny Roman numeral. That's stupid. Flip right by that. You know, I already know that, is what I thought. And so I go to how it works. Now, read how it works. And how it works, you know, they go into these steps and things. I know the steps. I've done the steps. Every meeting I've gone to, I've done the steps. I've read them, and I've done the ones that applied at the time I read them in my head. That's how I did the steps. And I read the first step, I said, right. Second step, yeah. Third step, well, I'm here, aren't I? Fourth step, doesn't really apply. Fifth step, you know, and I do them in my head at every meeting I went to, because you'd say, you know, we work the steps. So I go work the steps, and I thought that's what we did. I know some of you needed sponsors and things. I didn't need that. So I went to how it works in the book. Useless. I've already done the steps. That didn't work. So I read other stuff in there, and we agnostics. Okay, I consider myself an agnostic. And, you know, I got to that part where it says selfishness, self-centeredness. That we thought was the root of our troubles. And then there's that part that says lack of power was our dilemma. And both of those things just ripped into me. I thought alcohol was my problem. And yet, obviously, lack of power is my problem, because I've got a drink in my hand reading the big book, you know? So it really worked on me. I mean, it didn't get me sober, but I knew what we were talking about here. Okay, maybe it's not just alcohol. Selfishness and self-centeredness, I could see that in myself. So anyway, so we jump forward to Stanford, and I spent the rest of the night after being admitted teaching the rest of the staff about drugs and alcohol, and which is a joke. And the next day, I woke up, and I could hear laughter and smell food. And I remembered where I was, which was really depressing. And so I walked down the hall, and on this side was a closed door with laughter, and on this side was an open door with a breakfast buffet. I wasn't particularly hungry, but I'm not dumb. I'm not going in that room. So I come over here, and I get some food, and I'm sitting there eating it. And the door opened, and all of you came out, blah, 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 blah. And you all came around, and you said, "Oh, good, fresh meat. Hi, who are you? Blah, blah, blah." You know, and I'm like, just leave me alone. Fuck you. You know, and I hear this thump. And I look behind me, and this guy's having a seizure on the floor. Well, won't you leave me alone for just a minute so I can eat breakfast, you know? Now I got to help this guy. So we help this guy, who, by the way, did not get sober. Because when you have a seizure due to alcohol withdrawal, you don't get to see it. You're unconscious. Everybody else got to see it. Maybe one other person in the room had a spiritual experience at that moment. I didn't. I just sort of had this lousy medical experience. We got him going again, and off he went to the ICU, and And all of you came back in and you said, oh, how'd you know how to do that? Said, well, I'm a doctor. Oh, a doctor. You're the treatment center. What's that all about?
Alcoholic.
Fuck you. And so I detoxed like all week, and I was just sick and weak. Of course, the treatment director, the program director, wanted to meet the doctor who was going to stay for just one or two days. He wanted to meet me right away. Okay, all right, I'll stay for a week. Because I, you know, on some level, I knew this was my opportunity. I knew this was my chance. Here I am without alcohol for the first time in, you know, years and years and years. And so I recognized it for the opportunity that it was, expensive though it might end up. So a week later, I got to go into this room with the laughter, and it turned out it was this woman giving a lecture. She was a doctor, and she had about 8 years of sobriety, and it was a lecture about alcoholism, and she was great. It was a great lecture. It was funny, and it was factual, and it was from her experience and was also scientific, and it was fabulous. And she got to the odds of success, and she said, now, 3 out of 10 of you will be sober at the end of the year. There were 15 of us in the room. So we're all looking around at each other trying to think who's going to be sober. And I'm seriously thinking maybe 2 of them will be sober. I don't think it's going to be me because I know the answer. And then she asked, now who here has used needles? Well, she was cute, you know, so I raised my hand. And she said, oh, good, what do you do? I said, I'm a doctor. She said, oh, it's great. You know the odds for doctors using needles getting sober? This I didn't want to hear. And she said, fewer than 3 in 100 will be sober at the end of the year. So I went up to her after the meeting, lecture, whatever, and I said, what should I do? And she said, if I were you, I would do everything anybody tells you. And I said, well, where should I start? And she said, if I were you, I would go to my room, get on my knees, and ask God for help. And that's what I did. I went down to my room, and I got on my knees, and I said, God, please help me, because I can't do this. And I got back up, and I went back to her, and I said, well, now what should I do? And she said, well, and she said, who are you again? No. And she said, I'm a little self-centered. She said, well, what are they telling you to do? I said, well, they're telling me to turn in my license. She said, so turn in your license. So I went down the hall and turned in my license, kind of. There used to be a drug diversion program in the state of California. The assembly in their wisdom has taken it away. But it used to be that there was a program whereby you were monitored. If you were an alcoholic physician, you'd get monitored and you'd do urine samples and things like that. And they don't care about you, really, if you're clean and sober. They only care about you if you're not. You know, they don't bother you if you stay sober. And so it's actually a pretty fun program to be a part of. And I actually had the opportunity to work with them for 8 years on the board of directors of that program before it went belly up. It didn't really go belly up, but anyway, it was dismantled. And unfortunately, it no longer exists. So anyway, I went down the hall, I turned in my license. I said, whatever. I gave up. Okay? I gave up. Whatever. That afternoon, there was a fight that had nothing to do with me, and because of the emotional turmoil in the room, we all went for a walk, and we ended up at the Stanford Cathedral or Chapel. I guess it's Chapel, Stanford Chapel. Now, during that week, where I've been, I gotta hurry. During that week, we've been going to AA meetings, and people have been talking about two people in particular talked about experiences they had where they were convinced they had a spiritual change. They were convinced that something had happened to them that had changed their life all of a sudden. And one was a physician and one was a pharmacist. And I thought it was really interesting that these intelligent, educated people were convinced that they were sitting on the beach and they said, dear God, please help me because I don't know how to get sober. And the winds blew and the lights changed and the sky turned from yellow to pink and the sound is different and they were a different person. And I thought, wow, you believe that? How weird that you would believe that. I mean, you know better. You know that can't be possible. So we go to the Stanford Chapel. In the Stanford Chapel, there are these blocks with scripture, I guess, chiseled into all of them, all the way around, all the way up to the ceiling, and there's just sayings everywhere. So you got 15 or 20, because there's some Al-Anons with us, 15 or 20 really screwed up people walking around staring at all this. And I was reading one, and it just jumped out at me, and it said, we are all on earth for a purpose, even if only to give a drink of water to a thirsty stranger. And this thing just came out of the wall, and I turned inside out, and I was a different person. I mean, it just changed for me. I was just in a different place. And I felt really weak and weird. And I went over and I sat down next to Judy, the little Al-Anon nurse who had taken us for the walk. She said, Dave, you look a little dazed. Come and sit down. And she said, what do we do? Or I said, what do we do anyway? She said, let's pray. And so we did. You know, we sat there and prayed and everything. And all I can tell you is I was a different person. I mean, from that moment on, I turned inside out. So since then, I have tried to do what you tell me to do. I've been working the steps, and I worked the steps and all of that, and I got a sponsor, and fast forward, and I got divorced, and I met a woman, and she happened to be an AA. I met her outside of AA. We met actually at work, and it turned out she was an AA. So anyway, we got married, and we moved to Sacramento. I got a new job. Now, interestingly enough, I work in the prisons, which is kind of fascinating because I'm surrounded with drugs and alcohol and drug addicts and alcoholics. But the thing is, I still try and do what I'm told, you know, on any level. Just recently, I had a job change come up. And, you know, God's at work in our lives. And how do we know that? Well, you may not know it. I have found that I can put up tests. And I can give them to God, and God will show me that God is there. This is kind of a weird thing, but I suggest to you, you know, in the beginning, when we first get sober, we may not believe in God. I mean, you may have a God of your childhood or something, you know, and then it kind of comes down to the doorknob, somebody says at a meeting, you know, and somewhere between those two is what? There's like nothing there. And so what is God as we understand him? And so at the beginning, there's this word God, and I don't know what that is, and I pray to it. And so then I got to be without a drink. And so my concept of God has become the understanding of what God has done for me. All of the things that have happened since have been my God. Like all of you, and it's all the things that have happened in my life have all been as a result of this God thing, and so it's expanded over time. And I also, you know, I think that comes from the fact that God is within us, and you hear that, you know, meaning, and what does that really mean? And I suspect that we are all as good as we're ever going to be inside somewhere when we get here. We're all filled up with God, and yet we have encountered and picked up and dragged with us all of this junk through life. We carry it, and we use it as a shield and as an excuse. We're really good at that, you know, and it's heavy on our shoulders, and it's depressing, and we feel really crappy, and we come in here. And the process of finding our God is not learning, and it's not picking up useful things, tools, you know, like we say, you've got to pick them up. It's not about picking up tools, and it's not about learning. It's about discarding. It's about uncovering. We go through the process, through the steps, of getting rid of that stuff that stands between us and the God that is everywhere, you know? And so, like the fourth step, for example, I love doing the fourth step. I found the fourth step was really easy. All of the resentments in the fourth step, I already knew them. We already know all those resentments. It's not like we have to think, oh, gee, I don't think I have any resentments, you know? I mean, we knew it's the third grade science teacher, it's you know, the president, it's the IRS, it's that guy I knew back in high school, it's my mother, it's my father. I mean, we know all those things. Everybody knows their resentments. You carry them around. So it's not a difficult exercise to come up with resentments. The hard part is sharing it with somebody, right? It's their ego. It's their pride. It's the thing that says, I want to make it through life on my own. I don't need any help, you know? And if God is inside all of us and works with us all together, that's the kind of thing that can kill me. That level of isolation where I say, I can do it by myself, that's going to kill me. All right. How do I get to that? Let me tell you about a couple things that have happened since. Oh, I know. I was talking about giving God a test. So one day, 3 years sober. I come out of my office, medical office, and my wife and I are going to have a date. Okay, this is not my ex-wife. Anyway, my wife and I are going to have a date, and we set this up in advance. We're going to have a date. I got to be home by 6 because we're going out. We don't ever go out. This is going to be fun. We'll talk about fun in a minute. But we're going to go out, and so I got to go home. And in front of my car, by the car door, there's a guy who has a big cut on his hand, and he doesn't speak English, and I don't speak his language. And he holds up his hand to me and points to the sign that says physician and surgeon outside my office. And he's blocking my car, you know, which is the only car in the parking lot. And I'm like, what is this, God? You know, I got 10 minutes. So it flashes through my mind. You know, I can drive him to the hospital. Well, he doesn't have any money. They're not going to do a good job with that. I can take him to the county. That's too far away. He doesn't have any money. They're not going to do a good job with that. I can blow him off. That isn't going to work. Okay, God. All right. You know, I'll go inside and fill him up. So I bring him in. I call my wife. The phone is busy. Sit him down. I numb up his hand. I fill him up. Forget it. The night is blown. I mean, it's going to take 45 minutes. Do a good job of his hand. Put it all back together. Call my wife. Line is busy. She's probably calling the cops, you know. We got divorced for a reason, you know. Anyway, we weren't getting along too well. So there you go. And he's going like this, no, I don't want any money, you know. Go. Here's some antibiotics, give me some antibiotics. You need to have these out in a week. What? You know. Anyway, we worked through that. Let him go. And I drove home the speed limit on purpose. I said, God, this is up to you. How are you going to fix this? I am in deep doo-doo. I stopped at every stop sign. My wheel stopped. I don't know if you guys have ever done that, but my wheels actually came to a stop at stop signs, all right? This is a test on purpose. Let me see you fix this one, God. You know? Let me see you get me sober. Let me see you fix this one, God. And I got home, and my wife had just gotten off the phone, and there was a family emergency in San Diego, and we weren't going out that night. Well, she didn't even notice I wasn't there, really, on some level, and we weren't going out. Now, if I had done any of the things I wanted to do, that would not have really been a good thing to have done. You know, my way out, all the ways I could think of to fix this problem, other than, let's see you fix this problem, would have failed miserably. So I suggest, and this has worked for me on numerous occasions, I suggest if you're having trouble with the whole God thing, give him a test. You know, there's something coming up and you don't see any way it's going to work out at all, any good, and don't try and make it work out at all. Totally extract yourself from the situation, play by the rules, stop at the stop signs, you know, don't cut any corners, and sit back and watch what happens. Most recently, I had a job offer of change, and I was pretty happy where I was, and this new job came up, which would kind of totally change where I work and how and what I do. And I don't know if I should take it or not. And, well, maybe I'll take it if they offer it to me all the way through after the interviews. I go through the interviews. They still offer the job. Man, I don't know if I should take it or not. I don't. And then I realized, wait a minute. I didn't try and get the job. You know, I wasn't looking for the job. The job was brought to me, and it was said, here, we want you to do this. Here, you go through these interviews. We still want you to do this. Now we've met you. We'll take you anyway. You know, they're going to pay me the same. It's not like an advancement or anything, but it's a totally different job. And I realized, that's not my doing. You know, that's one of the things I should do now, because I had nothing to do with it. To the extent that I can remove myself from the process, it works out better than I could ever have made it work. Very important lesson. It wasn't until I stopped trying to stop drinking that I got sober. You know? It wasn't until I stopped doing things my way that I started to get satisfaction out of how things were going. And that's the God within us stuff. You know, when my blinders are on and I'm doing it my way, it's not going to work. Now, I wanted to mention fun, because I have trouble with fun. There's this thing about having fun. We absolutely insist on having fun, you know. I don't know about you. I've always had a problem with fun. I've never really been able to really quite get a hold of it. What is, there's things that are going to be fun. I got lots of those things. They're going to be fun. You know, we're going to go on a cruise. That'll be fun. We go on the cruise. We're going to go to the port. That'll be fun. We get to the port. We're going to go to the beach. That'll be fun. We go to the beach. We're sitting on the beach. I guess we're having fun. You know, this fun. We're going to get back in the boat later and have dinner. That'll be fun. And I'm always putting fun off. I'm always, for some reason, and it's my ego that's doing this, it says, you know, we're going to do this. It's going to be right. You're going to do it. You're going to have fun. It's going to be for you. And what I'm finding out is that I am already having fun. I just have a hard time seeing it. This is fine. This is all fine, you know. My daily work, moment to moment, a day at a time here, a moment at a time, it's pretty damn good. It's actually fun. And little moments will come in and they'll be kind of funny maybe, or maybe poignant, or maybe some compassion or a feeling or something will come up, or a little happiness for someone else, or a thought of the past, or an expectation of the future, which is the trap, you know, the future. And I realize I'm enjoying where I'm at, which really is the trick, isn't it? I mean, that's why we're here, because we have a hard time enjoying where we're at. We have a hard time having fun. My wife always says, well, she doesn't always say it, darn it. You know, she will say, like, let's have sex. And she says, that'll be fun. I'm thinking, I don't... It's good, you know. I mean, I don't know. Fun is like being on a carousel or something, but anyway. All right, so the last thing... two other things. Who cares how many things? Just get to it. I want to tell you about the Lord's Prayer. When I was going through my I'm going to get sober soon and you're going to get me sober phase, one thing I never did was the Lord's Prayer. We'd all stand around in a circle, and if I held your hand, because sometimes I was just insolent, you know, arrogant, but if I held your hands, I was not going to stoop to that level. I mean, that's really dumb. And there were a few of us around the room. We'd always connect with our eyes, like, yeah, yeah. You know, who's the joke on here, really, you know? Yeah, I'm not, I don't have to say the Lord's Prayer. And since I got sober, I have yet to open my eyes during the Lord's Prayer. It's been a few years, you know? And I can comfortably close my eyes and reflect on parts of the Lord's Prayer and how much it applies to our recovery process. I mean, I know it's kind of Christian, and it's a little embarrassing to me that we are a little religious in that sense, and I wish we weren't. But I do like what the Lord's Prayer says. There's really cool stuff in there about forgiving other people. You know, we have to forgive them first and keep me from temptation. I mean, how clear is that? You know, keep me out of the bars. Well, yeah, it's God's job to keep me sober, you know, and I mean that. It's my job not to swallow alcohol. It's God's job to keep it from going in my mouth. As long as I don't have anything to do with it, I'm likely to stay sober, you know. So keep me from temptation. I like it. And so today I can close my eyes with the prayer. So I just recently went to San Antonio for the International Convention, and I had been to Minneapolis before that, and I'd been to San Diego before that. And I can tell you, the International Conventions are amazing. Amazing. If you get the opportunity, you got to go do this. They're just incredible. They're every 5 years. What's amazing about them is the name tags. To me, anyway, what's amazing is the name tags. Everybody in town, all of a sudden, is wearing a name tag. All the alcoholics are no longer anonymous. You know who all of them are. They all got these big name tags on. All the people without name tags are anonymous, and they're not alcoholics. So you can ignore them, you know, and you end up talking to these people. You walk into a restaurant, Ed from Texas, how's the food? Not so good. I mean, okay, thanks, Ed. You know, I mean, we're everywhere. There's 50, 60, 70,000 of us in town. It's the biggest convention any town will ever do. So we're in Minneapolis, in the world's largest mall, and because the name tags are so, they're just, it's so cool to have them on and to see everybody, because you don't take them off. You don't take them off. I mean, right to the airport, we'll hang out with the name tag. So I'm in the mall at the end of the thing. Sunday morning, it all winds up. We went back to the mall, a group of us, and we're having lunch and everything. We get done. I'm buying a pair of jeans. And I'm in line, and there's this gal behind me. She's like 24, and I'm wearing my name tag. And she says, you know, these name tags, what is it with these name tags? And I said, well, I can't tell you. It's a secret. Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. We're an organization. We all get together every 5 years. And this week we're all in Minneapolis. And she said, what kind of organization is that? I said, well, we're all alcoholic, and we don't drink, and we get together, and it's really quite a weekend. She says, well, what do you do? I said, oh, it's fabulous. We rent the stadium for the whole weekend. We have big stadium meetings with 60,000 people at a meeting. We blocked off the street. We had 5 different stages in the street with different kinds of bands playing music all at the same time. Everybody's out there dancing, go to restaurants. I mean, we just have a great time. She says, wow, that really sounds like fun. How do you join? And I said, well, first you have to drink, you know, a lot. You drink a lot. And then you might get married, get divorced, get a job, lose a job, get in a car wreck, go to court, do it again and again and again. And finally, you might find your way to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, wow, that doesn't sound worth it. And I said, you know, believe me, it's worth it. Thank you very much, everybody.